So what a great morning we had, very inspirational, and I think very consistent with our goals and objectives of collaboration, unification, and curing our loved ones. We're very fortunate this afternoon to have a sort of a further discussion about the effects of war and to discuss this in a couple of different ways. We are going to start our discussions today with a presentation by Kevin Kit Parker, who has a number of titles. He's a PhD and the Thomas D. Cabot Associated Professor of Applied Science at Harvard University. Patrick and I first met Kit at a meeting that we had in a small room at the Boston Harbor Hotel, and we were Kevin really brought it to that meeting, I will tell you. He impressed us in ways that were beyond belief. He subsequently came and testified with us in October when Dennis Kucinich held hearings at the House so that we could get on the record the state of collaboration or lack thereof and the state of where we were in mental health activities. Tom Insel, who's joined us, was also a part of that conversation, and Kit did a very incredible job. Kit has got a unique background in that not only is he a brilliant scientist, but he is a practicing clinician. He is a former member of the 82nd Airborne, the 10th Mountain Division. He's a current member of the Gray Team. He received the Bronze Star for his combat activities, and he currently serves in the Special Operations of the Rhode Island National Guard and U.S. Army Reserve. He is in combat once a quarter, seeing what's happening to our soldiers and doing something about it. Please welcome Kit Parker.
Thank you very much. Can you cue up the laptop? Thanks. So thanks to the organizers, thanks to Garen, thanks to Patrick for putting this together. Thanks for inviting me and having me as a part of this. I'm just going to jump right into it. So I'm going to talk about traumatic brain injury. This is a video of a controlled detonation of an IED. This was my last patrol in June of 2009 in the Tangi Valley in eastern Afghanistan. This area, the Tangi Valley, is hit quite often with IEDs. It's a pretty contentious area. And what happens when this IED goes off, this is a controlled det, but when it hits a vehicle, or actually when the IED goes off, there's a wave, I'm sorry, I'm putting a laser right above your head. Let me point over here. Sorry about that. You get an energy waveform called a Friedlander, which starts to propagate away from the explosion, and this is the problem. When this energy wave hits besides the fireball, but when the energy wave hits an object, it looks something like this. This is Jell-O. This was a movie that we put together yesterday in my laboratory to kind of illustrate what happens. Josh Goss is a Marine in my laboratory. He's done two tours in Iraq, and so I said, hey, listen, we need an IED demo. He knew exactly what to do. So you can imagine that if that energy waveform has blown apart some metal and you've got a penetrating wound into the head, just like that finger was impacting that Jell-O right there, the brain is sloshing around inside the skull because you've got a projectile, high-energy projectile entering the skull. Now, not all brain injury is due to a projectile. This is a shock tube that we put together. You can see that a single pulse of energy hitting this Jell-O, you see this compression wave moving around the outside towards this Jell-O, and you see an expansion also with the Jell-O in this direction. So the brain is not, unless you're an octopus, the brain is not a mechanical organ. Right? The brain is protected. It's inside the skull. In the octopus, the brain deforms so the octopus can swim through grates and stuff like this. So this causes a problem. Having these energy wavefronts move inside the skull, is you have cells that are being sheared, cells that are being crushed, tissues that are being torn and stretched. So a variety of different injuries, and although this Jell-O is homogeneous, the brain is heterogeneous. There's a lot of different structures inside there. So as these waveforms are bouncing around, the brain is bouncing off the inside of the skull. These waveforms are ricocheting off of there. So you actually have 1,000 of these dual waves ricocheting through the brain, doing all kinds of damage to cells. this is what my lab is interested in. We didn't originally work on the brain. We were interested in the heart, but when people started trying to kill me with IEDs, I figured I better get a piece of this. So this is where it starts. After that wave front is hit, you get a situation like this. This was in March of 2009. Same road, going in the opposite direction. 500 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, IED, blew up. Blew this MRAP vehicle over. It had a mine roller up there in front of it. Four guys inside of it. We ran up to pull these guys out and see what was happening. The guy that was sitting in the back had a compression fracture of the lumbar vertebrae. The guy in the turret got his head ricocheted off the back of his 50 caliber machine gun. He had multiple facial fractures and a compound fracture of his leg. The driver had a brain injury. Actually, they all had brain injuries. The vehicle commander, this was his 11th time to be blown up. He suffered 11 TBIs over the course, and this wasn't the last time he was blown up on this tour. So you've got young NCOs, young soldiers out there that have been blown up a dozen times. A dozen times they suffered a traumatic brain injury since 9/11. So we have this growing cadre of our professional warriors that are out there, they're walking around, and the concern is, what does the future hold for them? This is the timeline of traumatic brain injury. So there's a variety of different things that are happening. I'm sorry, my slide's getting cut off here. From the nanosecond level, when you have protein conformational changes, when that blast wave is ricocheting through the brain, all the way up through the end of the epidemiological lifespan. Cells are torn, sheared, axons are pulled back, synapses are dislocated, blood vessels are ripped. And over the course of time in these patients, you see remodeling, maladaptive remodeling of the brain. You see maladaptive remodeling of the cerebral vasculature. And the data now is pretty clear that traumatic brain injury can potentiate a variety of neurodegenerative diseases, including Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. So the outlook for these young soldiers is kind of bleak right now. So, you know, here's the challenge going forward, understanding these problems and trying to look for the therapeutic opportunity. Now, if you think about the spatial scales, you know, if you talk about the whole organism, that soldier, he's about a meter length scale, about a meter high. Your brain is on the order of 10 to 20 centimeters. The neural networks stretch out over thousands of microns. These are the wiring diagrams that you've heard so much about in the last couple of days. Single neurons down to the synapse, where you have this chemical transmission of information between different cells, all the way down to these integrin proteins. And integrin proteins are these proteins which maintain the mechanical connectivity between the cytoskeleton, or the structure that maintains the structural integrity of the neuron, and the extracellular matrix proteins like collagen, fibrinin, that maintain the structural integrity of the tissue. So at least nine orders of temporal magnitude, if you start talking about nanosecond conformational changes in protein up to the seconds of the blast. It's many more orders of temporal magnitude if you spread it out over the warrior's lifespan. Nine orders of spatial magnitude. So this is a fairly serious scaling problem. And I look at this maybe a little bit differently than I'm an infantry officer in the reserve, so I'm not a physician, I'm a physicist. And I look at things in terms of scaling laws. You know, a physicist knows that when things are really big, you use Newtonian mechanics to solve them. When things are really small, you use quantum mechanics. In biology, we don't think about scaling laws, but all of us understand scaling laws in economics. If my daughter and I run a lemonade stand this Saturday out in Waltham and we make a few bucks, no one's going to make me CEO of Coca-Cola the next Monday, right? Because everyone understands economic scaling laws, right? So if you really want to think about diseases, maybe one thing that we should think about is the scaling laws. Because you think about disease as an emergent property of a complex, functional or dysfunctional, in this case, system. Understanding these scaling laws and understanding the spatial scale at which the disease is first manifested, we can diagnose it, that we see, hey, something's different here. Maybe that's a spatial scale where our original search for therapeutics should start. So that's what my group works on. And so I'm not going to dive down into the details of the research that we do. I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview. But I want to talk about some of the issues that I see in doing traumatic brain injury research. And keep in mind, I come from the outside. I wasn't a brain researcher before this started, before Jeff Ling came into my life. Jeff Ling and Al-Qaeda. Not that you should draw any connection about my quality of life. So My group has an algorithm that we follow, and we've been doing this for heart disease for some years, and now we're applying the same algorithm to traumatic brain injury. And the whole idea is to develop a novel scientific hypothesis, develop a technology, build an assay, build a tool to test this hypothesis. Test the hypothesis. If we're right, then what we want to do is start to scale up this assay or this technology so we can translate it to pharma and biotech so that they can run with this. And our revisit the relationship with biotech and pharma a little bit later on. But we came into this kind of as an insurgent group. There's a specific dogma that suggests that the neuronal cell death in traumatic brain injury is due to membrane poration. We looked at this a little bit differently. If you survey the last 10 to 15 years of work on cellular mechanotransduction, it suggests that those integrin proteins that I talked about, the nanometer scale, that those proteins which transduce mechanical forces and propagate mechanical forces into the cell might have an important role in this. And so we suggested that diffuse axonal injury is really the issue, not neuronal death, and that integrin signaling might be a problem. So why do I say these integrin proteins versus membrane poration? I'll explain it to you the way I explained it to my grandmother some years ago. So many years ago, I spent the summer at the Marine Biological Lab working with the squid giant axon, which is where, you know, many neuroscientists cut their teeth. And I was always surprised at how floppy the membrane was on these neurons. And so when I explained this to my grandmother, we're Tennesseans and quite proud of it, I said, you know, it's floppy like the skin on a hound dog. And she immediately understood, you know, what I was dealing with. But the point is that floppiness means that it's not a good conduit of mechanical energy. Right, there's got to be a more efficient way to get the mechanical energy into the cell to induce these pathological responses in neurons. Integrins are that. So we are working this algorithm right here. And I'll just give you a quick overview of what we're doing right here. So in order to do this, and we're funded through Jeff Ling's PREVENT program at DARPA, what we're trying to do is build a set of vertically integrated assays to mimic the energy spectra of an IED blast and impose it on engineered tissue. Now, yesterday, Francis Collins talked a little bit about the new tools that we need to build, and one of the things he talked about was iPS cells, neurons derived from iPS cells. He talked a little bit about engineered tissues. Well, that's what we do in my group. We do tissue engineering, but we don't look at it as an end result. It's a tool by which we use to get to work. So we built a variety of different assays here, all the way down so we can get down to molecular blast injury with electromagnetic tweezers, high-velocity stretchers, so we can look at what's happening when that blast wave is propagating through the brain and stretching out these neurons like you saw in the Jell-O. Blast bioreactors so that we can simulate the impact of the brain slamming up against the inside of the skull. So this is in a collaboration with Jeffrey Birdie. We built originally some of these blast bioreactors where we take neurons, we grow them in a dish, we hammer these things, then we take a look at the resulting physiological and morphological changes in these cells. And what we found right away is that we could mimic some of the things that the neuropathologists are reporting that they're seeing in patients. But we wanted to move something towards something a little bit more controllable, something that we could manage. And so we built these high-velocity stretchers. And what we do is we can look at two different things here. We can take a look at the cerebral vasculature. Something that distinguishes blast TBI is this tendency for these patients to show vasospasm. Last night, if you were at Fenway Park, when you heard this fantastic presentation from the people from Boston University, and they showed all these tau entanglements surrounding the blood vessels there in the brain, a lot of people suggest that this hypothesis, the blast wave, once it impacts the soldier, is propagating up inside the skull via the cerebral vasculature. So we're looking both at the vasospasm problem and the neuronal injury problem. And we can build engineered vascular tissues, and we can build engineered neural networks on these kinds of dishes. We can stretch them really fast, and we can take a look at them. We can induce this blast-induced vasospasm in the dish. Matt Hemphill, who's here in the audience today, is working his entire thesis to try to understand what's happening with these neurons. And you might not be able to see it right here, but what you can see is when we stretch these neurons out and we give them this high-velocity stretch to mimic that blast wave going through the brain, we see the various morphological changes in these neurons. You see mechanical failure of focal adhesions and the like. Borna DeBerry in my laboratory has worked also to develop the whole model of doing molecular blast injury. And what we had this idea was that, if I tug on a cell, the mechanical forces are propagated throughout the body of the cell via the cytoskeleton. It's like a conduit for information. It's like if someone in the back of the room was holding the end of a rope and I was handling the other end, you know, if I'm tugging out right here, they can feel me tug on it. These forces propagate down throughout the cell. So we had this hypothesis that if we can yank on a neuron in a specific part of the neuron, we can see the injury forces propagate throughout the neuron. So we take these neurons, we grow them in a dish, we attach these paramagnetic beads on them. Borna DeBerry built this magnetic tweezer with Josh Goss in my laboratory. We yank on these beads, and take a look at this video here. This is a neuron that's got a fluorescent dye in it. It's got a long axon extending all the way down. You can see this red arrow. I'll get to that in a moment. This red dot right here is a paramagnetic bead. We apply a small force on the order of a few nanonewtons to this bead. The axon breaks hundreds of microns away. In other words, the force propagates through this entire neuron all the way down here, and that's where you see the fracture. That's where you see the diffuse axonal injury. So hundreds of microns away. And so you saw in the last set of presentations when we talked about the connectome, and you saw Jeff Lichtman's work, and you've seen all this fantastic work showing the fiber tracks extending throughout the brain. These forces, even though it's applied at one particular point, they radiate. And sometimes the cells themselves are the pathway through which these injury forces are propagating throughout the cell. So now that we've got all these models, we're working on developing a systematic understanding of the mechanical forces required to injure these neurons, these vascular tissues, and understand the chemical cascades that are turned on by these mechanical forces. And the whole idea is that if we understand these chemical cascades that are triggered by integrin stimulation or integrin injury, this type of focal adhesion injury, then we can start to identify which molecules along that chemical cascade are vulnerable to therapeutic exploitation. So the question is, you're doing all this great work in the bench. How does this translate out into coming up with potential therapeutics? So, I redid my slide after Francis Collins gave a great presentation yesterday about the drug discovery process. We can talk more about that later, but this is the typical pathway that Francis went over, and I want you to take a look at a couple of numbers. Take a look at the average cost, or the approximate cost to launch a drug, about $1.8 billion. Take a look at the number of years it requires to get a drug out there to manufacture and launch through FDA approval. Quite a number of years, right? So it's pretty expensive. And it means that before you start this process, you need to have a few different questions answered. You need to answer, what's the disease? You need to know what it is, right? You need to know, can we diagnose it? Do we have a biomarker? Do we have an in vitro model? Can we do high throughput screening with this model? Because high throughput screening is the way pharma does drug discovery. Do we have an in vivo model? How many neurological diseases do you know that fail in three or four of these? All right, a lot of them. TBI is no different. We're still arguing about what TBI is. We're still arguing about how to diagnose it. You know, every patient is a little bit different. You know, it's very challenging right now as to how to determine what TBI is and where's the therapeutic opportunity. But you've got to have most of these questions answered before you can start here. And you also have to make sure that you've got the appropriate tools to test this hypothesis and grow this thing to some type of therapeutic molecule. How are we doing this now? And there was an article about a year or so ago in Science Translational Medicine that talked about the failure to develop effective drugs for traumatic brain injury. So right now, what most people are doing is repurposing existing drugs. Since we don't have all these questions answered, there are significant indications from studies with other drugs that we can start in at phase two, phase three, and we can run a clinical trial this way. So in other words, we're chopping time off this pipeline, and we're obviously saving quite a bit of money, or at least we're trying to. But why are we doing this? We don't have the answers to the aforementioned questions. We don't have the money to pursue the traditional course. We certainly don't have the time. If you're a young soldier who's patrolling in Helmand Province today and going to get hit by an IED, and someone's going to get hit by an IED today, by the end of the day today, there'll be several, maybe a half dozen different TBI casualties in Afghanistan. You certainly don't have time. And maybe we've lost our ability to do emergency science. In other words, we have a medical emergency which has arisen on the battlefield. We need to move quickly to appropriate resources and get the talent at the point of impact, no pun intended, so that we can address this emergency. So let's go and address some of these questions, because like I said, you know, there's still a lot of different questions, and we're trying to develop in vitro models in my laboratory based on a hypothesis of what we think the disease is, diffuse axonal injury, but there are other people that also have valid hypotheses, not as good as ours, It's always that way, right? That are working other angles, right? And it's important. We need to have competing hypotheses. I'll talk a little bit about that later. But I think one of the things we have to think about is we got to help pharma. We got to work with them. They're not the enemy. They are the instrument. And we have to work with them to make sure that they have everything they need to develop these kinds of therapeutics. And I think a lot of times, I mean, I spend a lot of time talking to pharma. Mostly it's in the context of doing the cardiac research that I do. Whenever I try to bring up the subject of traumatic brain injury, I get a polite no thanks. They're not interested in this. But we need to help them. And I have to say that I don't necessarily agree with what NIH and Dr. Collins talked about yesterday, developing this intramural drug discovery. Rather than taking that money and trying to, you know, federalize drug discovery, what I would do is sit down with pharma and say, hey, listen, how can we help you do your job better? If you need new tools, if you need new data, if you need new insights into a disease, one of the easiest things you can do is build a new tool. If you build a new tool, you'll measure something different, right? And tool building has to be, and Dr. Collins spoke about this yesterday, has to be an important part of this campaign moving forward. There are a variety of different diseases, if you're talking about autism, Alzheimer's, or TBI, who don't have a good set of in vitro or in vivo models. And everything's dead in the water if you don't have those models. So we need to build new tools. We need to build new scientists. So how does pharma start building a drug? Well, they start off here in a dish, in a 386-well dish. They start off with a robot, right? And they start doing this high-throughput screening. And they've invested billions of dollars in this kind of technology so they can quickly develop data. And when I go and I talk to pharmaceutical companies about things, I'm struck by a couple of different things. First of all, their model is very different than an academic research lab. I rely on small quantities of very high-quality data. They rely on large quantities of very low-quality data. So there's a disconnect there. And I'm not criticizing them. I mean, they do what they do because it's fast and always effective. We know that now. But it's fast and cost-efficient based on their current model. So maybe we need to help them build tools so that they can raise the quality of their data somewhat on par with the quantity of their data. This is what I recommend. If you're going to have one grand challenge for the One Mind campaign, we can talk about building new MRI, we can talk about building new microscopes, new computers, but the fact of the matter is we need to build a brain. We need a brain. Everyone would benefit from having a brain in their dish to work on. You know, what I need to do is I need to be able to give pharma a 1 cubic millimeter piece of brain that goes in every single one of these wells, where I replicate, where I exploit all of our strengths in micro and nanotechnologies, iPS-derived cells. I can replicate these cellular microenvironments, put them into a dish so pharma can do high-throughput screening on them. All the original drug discovery work can be done also in a dish. But it has to be scalable, all right? I have to be able to go from my single dish in my academic lab to a similar assay that they've got in all these pharmaceutical companies. So build a brain and start off with a 1 cubic millimeter piece. It's not very easy to build a 1 cubic millimeter piece of hippocampus. We need to retrofit new technologies to the existing robotic platforms that they've invested in. Let me tell you something. Pharma understands they get a challenge. They are not sitting around waiting for the good idea fairy to show up at the front door with a Fabutron, say, hey, try this. They've already made a capital investment in the equipment they do. The challenge is to develop technologies that we can retrofit to what they currently have. You think drugs are expensive now? What if we show up and say, hey, you need to chunk all this stuff out the window and build totally different platforms? What do you think that's going to do to the cost of drugs? It's going to skyrocket. So this is a very difficult engineering challenge to retrofit new assays to existing platforms. This is the way forward here. We also need to build an interdisciplinary scientific beast to work in pharma. Now, when I go and I talk to device makers, when I go and talk to pharma, I notice something very unique about them. If I go talk to a device maker, I meet a biologist, I meet an engineer, I meet a physician, I meet a mathematician, I meet a broad range of scientists. When I go and talk to pharma, I meet a biologist, a medicinal chemist, a biologist. So when I take a look at pharma, I'm not seeing the same interdisciplinary approach, which is distinguishing American science. It's not there. I never meet an engineer on one of these discovery teams. I never do. So put this in the context of TBI. What do I need to do? What kind of interdisciplinary beast do I need to go after the TBI problem? Well, I need to build a molecular neuroscientist that understands shock physics. That's not going to happen. But it might be easier for us to build a big tent. Build a big tent and get this cross-disciplinary effort in. It takes a big problem, you got to take a big tent. You got to bring people from all different disciplines in there. So somehow we have got to infect pharma with some type of cultural change that allows them to build on the strength of the American science experience right now, and that's interdisciplinary research. So let's talk about emergency science. Now, earlier, one of the speakers talked about what we did in the Manhattan Project, what we did, we put a man on the moon, the moonshot. These are great examples of emergency science, where there was a national security issue at stake, and we had to move quickly to address that. And those were great successes. We have failed a lot recently in emergency science. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the anthrax investigation for the anthrax attacks from 2002. I was in Afghanistan then, so it's kind of a blur. HIV, we nearly blew that. But the whole idea of our national capacity for emergency science needs to be relooked at. And certainly traumatic brain injury, as it affects the force, is a national security issue. And it's certainly an emergency issue. So, I mean, and this speaks broadly for the whole idea of emergency science, run a drill, develop interagency exercises to do this kind of thing. This is maybe not applicable to the TBI problem, but certainly the whole idea of interagency cooperation. DOD and NIH working together. I mean, how often do you think NIH sits down with someone who's an expert in shock physics, who understands what's happening when that Friedlander is propagating at you? It probably doesn't happen that often, because it traditionally hasn't been their lane, and that's okay, that's understandable. But now we have a complex problem, we got to bring these guys together. How does this help TBI? Well, we have to do expeditionary science. We got to push the science as far forward as we possibly can. And this doesn't matter, it might be diffusion tensor MRI that we put down range, it might be a biomarkers lab that we put down range, it might be approval of the IRB so we can understand with these soldiers as they come off the battlefield what's happening to them, rather than waiting 6 months, 12 months before they present in a Veterans Administration emergency room. So the whole idea of pushing the science as far forward on the TBI front is an important part of this emergency science model. Get people out there where the science is happening, where the problem has arisen, and see if we can drill down on it there. So let me just, my final slide, so if you're talking about the moonshot, what's the way ahead? Now, we could talk about specific scientific milestones, but my milestones are going to be different than a neuroscientist that's coming at this, and that's fine. Because an important part of this, understanding the disease, evangelizing the findings, drawing people from different scientific disciplines, you know, getting away from this whole scientific tribalism that we have, getting everybody underneath the same roof, talking about these kinds of data, evangelizing the findings, sharing them, building and sharing tools, and this is a really important part of it. And a great example is what's happening right now with Carl Dieseroth, who you heard yesterday with optogenetics. I mean, they've really stepped up out there at Stanford to try to share this technology with as many people as possible. They've not kept it to themselves, and it's really a great example of how a scientific community can rally around a new tool and you can get disseminated through for the patient's benefits. But the other important thing is to support competing hypotheses. Groupthink, or the homogenization of ideas, is going to kill us on these really complex issues. The herd is going to run on the full frontal assault on traumatic brain injury. You got to take someone who's going to flank the problem. I mean, who's going to sit down and study the octopus brain, right? You know, that's unusual. Are you going to get funded to do that kind of thing? Maybe not by the study sections I encounter. But the whole idea of flanking the problem with the outside-the-box idea, saying, hey, listen, what's the difference between the human brain and the octopus brain? Is there something that we can borrow here? Is there some therapeutic opportunity, you know, buried somewhere within the octopus brain? Outside-the-box ideas are going to be very important if you want to do any type of radical shift in our current thinking on traumatic brain injury and curing these diseases. The whole idea is that when these guys run up there to pull these broken kids out of this MRAP, that there's a whole effort behind them supporting them. If I run up there and this kid's, you know, got a leg that's dangling off, I know how to apply a tourniquet to him. If I run up here and this guy's got his bell rung, I got no way of treating this guy right now. And right now he's at the genesis of these neurodegenerative diseases that might not appear for 20, 30 years on down the road. This is all I have. Thanks a lot for inviting me. Appreciate it. Questions? Nice. The guy at the microphone, please.
Okay. First of all, this weekend is Memorial Day, as we remember and recall all those soldiers that served with you, gave the ultimate sacrifice. Sure. You're a hero, Kit, to me and to millions of Americans, because you not only wore the uniform in battle, but you're wearing a new uniform. And that uniform makes you a first responder, just as you were to our country's needs in this war on terrorism. And that's the new war on terror.
Sure.
The terror of families that are prisoners of war.
Yeah.
Because of their traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
And I just want to thank you for being a true American hero who not only served over there, but never forgot your soldiers when you came home, because you knew the battle wasn't just over in Iraq or Afghanistan. The battle is when they get here at home, and never forgetting and never leaving our soldiers behind. Thank you, Kit Parker, for your service to our country.
Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it. I've been very fortunate that I've served with good teams downrange. These guys you saw running up to that blown up MRAP with me. Chris Macedonia, he's back there, going to speak to you tomorrow. A great team I've got in the lab, Layla Duravi and Matt Hemphill over there. And I think it speaks to what you can do when you get the right team, and whether or not there are people that are going to the battlefield or the people that are rallying in the laboratory. I've been surrounded by some great people. So whatever good we've done is probably because of that team, in spite of me, not because I'm a contributor there. But thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.